You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast on distinguishing and managing early-stage Alzheimer's disease, leveraging interdisciplinary collaboration for prompt identification and optimal patient management. My name is Brad Dickerson. I'm the director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Frontotemporal Disorders Unit and a professor of neurology at the Harvard Medical School. Joining me is my colleague in primary care, Dr. Chuck Vega. Chuck, so glad to have you on this podcast today. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
All right. Well, Brad, thanks very much for having me. My name is Chuck Vega. I'm a family physician and clinical professor of family medicine here at the University of California at Irvine, where I also direct our signature program of medical education for the Latino community, and I'm an assistant dean for culture and community education here at the UCI School of Medicine as well.
Well, wonderful to have you today. And I want us to take our listeners through a couple of cases that you and I can discuss, but maybe before we do that, we could start with the concept of multidisciplinary care. Since I'm in neurology and you're in primary care, maybe can you tell us a few initial thoughts on people like us trying to work together to manage patients with Alzheimer's disease or other types of dementia?
Right. So I didn't mention, but I've been a physician in the biggest safety net clinic here in Orange County for 27 years now. And all those patients who were 50 or 62 when I first started, they're still with me. And so therefore I do see a lot of older adults, and of course, age is the major risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. So I make this diagnosis all the time, and I always try to include a multidisciplinary team. There's so many needs that go beyond the patient here. So many times there might be mental health issues, there are social issues, there's issues around pharmacology and drug interactions, or drugs that could be potentially harmful for the patients, but maybe they actually need them because of other chronic illnesses. It's incredibly rare to see Alzheimer's disease without seeing 7 or 8 other chronic illnesses. So I think that every practice is different. And you have to look at your resource around you, but try to think of who you could depend on in your local network in terms of building a team of care, because it really makes a difference for patients and their supporters. And then think about community organizations or community resources such as a senior center or such as the Alzheimer's Association, who might be able to provide some resources to patients and supporters as well.
That's exactly the way I think about it too, Chuck, even though I'm a specialist. But maybe let's think about some of what you might consider roles and responsibilities. And I recognize this varies a lot by practice setting, and I'll get into how we handle things like this in neurology in a minute. But what would you say, Chuck, are the PCP's roles in identifying early symptoms and starting the diagnostic and even treatment process?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're the sentinels. And I know that I defer to your great experience and wisdom in the field of dementia. But it would not be a great spend of your time to be screening folks and trying to identify incident cases of cognitive impairment. But it's something we see all the time in our practices. And so I think it's just being aware and not letting things go. When a spouse or an adult child is telling me that, hey, my mom or my dad or my wife or my husband is slowing down, and they seem to be forgetting more, they keep repeating themselves, they got last week. That's going to be a case where I'm absolutely going to screen. I'm going to follow up with a screener. And this could be simple as a mini cog, which just takes a few minutes, but is still a good validated screening tool. So I think one is, don't just kind of let those comments go and dismiss them as a normal part of aging. They very often are not a normal part of aging, especially if they're pathological and causing disability. And then the other thing is that the American Academy of Neurology recommends screening for cognitive impairment beginning age 65. It's part of the wellness visit for Medicare as well. So there are some national guidelines and recommendations that really are encouraging clinicians overall to be screening for cognitive impairment. And I think that really is in our wheelhouse in primary care.
That's great. What do you say to your colleagues that say, with all the other things and that we have to do and competing priorities, I just don't find that there's more time than there is to just have a conversation. So I don't know how to fit a screening test, even the mini cog, into my busy workflow. How do you respond to that type of a
Well, I think that it's so important to identify cognitive impairment and do so as early as possible for a host of different reasons. There's medical reasons, especially now that we have potentially disease modifying treatment available, but a lot of social and family reasons as well. I don't think anybody, while there's a lot of fear and stigma around Alzheimer's disease and other dementia related conditions, I think that everybody would want to know that this is something that the process has begun and let's start doing something about it. Can be really simple, such as, you know, taking away some medications which might be harmful, recommending an evaluation for hearing. That's, to me, is one of the most common modifiable risk factors that we see for cognitive impairment in my practice. And then doing a workup for other potential causes and then getting the diagnosis cinched up in terms of making a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. So these are all really important roles. And yes, absolutely. Once making that diagnosis, starting those symptomatic treatments, thinking a lot about cholinesterase inhibitors for those more mild stages of dementia, I find that them to be helpful for patients and families as well.
Great, thanks. I find that there one place where there's a lot of variability in my primary care colleagues is, you know, they may do a screening test and identify a performance-based impairment that really, you know, is congruent with the symptoms and helps them make a referral. And some of my primary colleagues just make the referral from that initial assessment where they did maybe a mini cog or a MoCA or a mini mental and found an impairment. Others will go ahead and order not just the common blood tests that are used to screen for common comorbid conditions, but also sometimes an MRI. How do you think that primary care should think about when they should order an MRI versus when, if they're referring to a specialist, they should just let the specialist do it?
Oh, no, I want to give everything nice and sealed up to you. And so, you know, many patients, you know, they may be on the borderline and, you know, cases more mild cognitive impairment. Absolutely. When I'm doing those screening labs, I'm also ordering an MRI. And that's really, a CT is not just definitely substandard. Some patients, you know, can't get an MRI, but, you know, if you can, it's certainly much better to get brain imaging. And I just want to address, you know, because we are really busy. We have those eight other conditions. Plus, if you don't treat the patient's knee pain or back pain, you know, you're never going to get buy-in on management of their cognitive impairment. But, you know, the only superpower we have in primary care is continuity. So, yes, I have definitely, because a lot of these cognitive complaints might be kind of hand on the door moment. We've already spent 15 minutes together and I'm behind in my schedule. Oh, doc, I'm really forgetting things, you know, and I'm really having a hard time. And I just did my taxes and it took me 5 days. It used to take me 5 hours. You know, I say, well, let's go ahead. And I do want to look into this. Let's get you the next available appointment. The key is don't let it go. I can move it ahead to another appointment where we can focus on a little bit better, but don't let it go.
One of the other things I hear a lot about is, you might call it the elephant that's not in the room, which is the informant. So in primary care, you know, I think it's less common anyway for many patients to come in with some kind of a partner. How do you handle getting some collateral history from an informant who knows the patient well?
Well, I will actually ask the patient if it's okay, you know, in our using technology now, either through telehealth with video, or even just a simple phone call to someone who knows the patient well, and maybe brought up some of these issues. And wanted the, you know, patient to talk about them. I'll try to loop them into the conversation, of course, with the patient's permission. I usually get it. Why? Because I know the patient over time. And yes, there is fear and there is stigma. But because the patient knows and trusts me over 6, 10 years, what have you, I think that that's much easier to get their trust. And a lot of times the informant, often a family member, is very relieved to actually get their story out there, have it accurately told by themselves, and then we can move forward together with a plan of care for the patient.
So from the specialist perspective, we love it when people are referred from a doctor like Dr. Vega, who have been through an initial workup and have a nicely packaged referral. Depending on whether that's true or not, we tend to start with a full set of questionnaires, validated instruments that are used to measure cognition, mood and behavior, daily function. And in this day and age, we're often giving those to people through a secure online platform ahead of the visit so they can take the time it requires to fill those out rather than trying to rush through doing them in the waiting room. And those are very helpful just because if the answer is no to whatever the set of questions is, you've got your whole list of pertinent negatives right there, and those are linked into the medical record. And so it makes it a lot more efficient than trying to do all of that through an interview. And then we do an interview with the patient, typically a separate interview with the informant. We try to do those in different rooms because we want to make sure people feel completely candid and tell us directly without having to worry about what the other person's going to think. Sometimes that's more challenging than other times, but we do our best to get independent histories like that. And I think the way you just described it, Chuck, makes a lot of sense from an efficiency perspective, is get the informant interview on the phone or through telehealth. But we ask people to come together to the clinic where we see people, so they're there together. And then we do a neurologic exam, general physical exam, and a mental status assessment that goes beyond just a mini mental or a MoCA. And, you know, depending on the patient's characteristics and the symptoms that they have, we may probe language to a greater degree, or executive function or visual spatial function to a greater degree than those screening tests allow for, using more in-depth, subspecialized, office-based cognitive assessment, not usually formalized tools like a neuropsychologist would use, but we certainly move in that direction. And then we often check the MRI ourselves, because you can't always, you know, if a radiologist is busily reading scans that don't have a clear description about what the concern is that led to the ordering of the scan, and cognitive impairment is just not enough, because you want to know where to look in from a localization standpoint to try to figure out, is there some kind of a lesion or even just regional atrophy in the medial temporal lobe specifically, maybe because the person has a memory impairment, or in the lateral temporal left temporal lobe, maybe because they have a language impairment. And a lot of times that's not in the report. And, you know, if we call the radiologist and take the time to talk them through what we're concerned about, we'll get all that information. But a lot of times you really have to take the time to collaborate like that. And then we often use FDG PET scans in our practice just because we find them to be more sensitive. And there's data on this to regional neurodegeneration. And they're Medicare reimbursed for the question of, is this person's cognitive impairment likely due to Alzheimer's disease or FTD? And then nowadays, we did this before, but increasingly now with reimbursement of amyloid PET, we get cerebrospinal fluid or amyloid PET biomarkers to try to seal the deal when it comes to the molecular diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, recognizing that it can be one of multiple diseases that may be present in a person with cognitive impairment, especially the older they are. So Chuck, why don't we turn now to a couple of quick patient vignettes, maybe starting with a simple one where the patient is, let's say, 72 years old, had been working until the last couple of years after they retired. And now this woman is presenting with her husband complaining that she has difficulties remembering to take her medications for hypertension. And this is something she's done on her own for years. So it's kind of annoying and a little concerning to her that she's finding it more difficult to keep up with this important medical compliance activity. So how would you approach a discussion of whether that type of a concern might be significant in a patient like this?
Well, I love this case because this is definitely ripped right from my practice. So having a chronic illness is at least like having a part-time job. And for a lot of my older adults with those 7 or 8 chronic illnesses, it's almost a full-time job. If you think about the need to take medication, keep up with your clinic appointments. Are they virtual now? Are they in person? You have to go to lab beforehand. You have to go maybe get some imaging studies, and we're doing preventive care at the same time. So it becomes really complex. So it is a complex task, no doubt about it. And for that patient who's always been steady, blood pressure controlled, refills getting done on time, everything moving forward, and then things start to fall away. The lab's not done, missed a couple appointments, has difficulty remembering to take medications. Absolutely, these are, you know, big red flags that there is something going on. Now, maybe it's not cognitive impairment. Maybe the patient's depressed, or maybe, especially if it's really recent, I ask, gee, is there something going on that, you think could help explain some of these issues you've been having? And then just be quiet. Oh, nice open-ended question. Oh, well, my sister just passed away. And it's like, oh, okay, well, that's a, full stop. Yes. So that, because that may very well explain, especially if it was 2 weeks ago. I'm not going to, be pressing, but if it's persistent and if there's signs of deterioration over a course of months, absolutely put them through a screening test. And many times it will turn out to be positive, I found. And so just another opportunity to act as a sentinel to detect this super important illness.
So you tend to, if a complaint like this comes up or a concern like this comes up as part of an annual wellness visit, do you try to do the screening that you need to do during that visit, or do you tend to set up, I'm sure if this is very individually specific, but do you generally tend to set up a problem-based focused visit to try to address a complaint like that?
I am an opportunist, and I know I'm supposed to have wellness visits, but I really do try to incorporate healthcare maintenance and prevention into all of my visits. And I have to go where the patient leads me, because if the patient comes in with headache, back pain, knee pain, and my blood pressure is completely out of control, and the chart just happens to say wellness visit, well, I'm going to do the work I'm supposed to do as a physician, and treat those symptoms and treat the patient and put those priorities first. So I think that for a lot of us in primary care, it is that approach, which is patient centered and patient first, is probably the one we tend to take. But we do have time. There's that golden moment where the back pain and the knee pain, they all just kind of magically disappear. And guess what? That's what we're going to do a lot of our screening. That's when we're going to do a lot of our healthcare prevention. And I find that system works, and I'm able to get my patients, all of whom very low health literacy, very low overall literacy, low income, I'm able to get the job done in terms of doing the screening for cognition and many other things too.
Great. The more you speak about it, the more I feel like I have some people I'd love to refer to you.
Well, I was going to use the term amoeba, but that just doesn't sound right. I don't think people want amoeba-like healthcare, but sometimes that's the way it feels. Like you just have to kind of shape and change in real time as a patient's telling you things in front of you. So,
makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I think, when I receive a referral from one of my primary care colleagues in the system, I always like to try to really take the opportunity of the electronic health record, in addition to, direct communication on the phone or in the hallway, to collaborate. And so, sometimes a primary care clinician pretty much feels like the problem might be depression or stress or a major life stressor that, led the person to get a 18 on their MoCA when last time they got a 28. And they say, I just want somebody else's eyes on this. And, I might see that patient and say, I think that they had a, poor night's sleep and they were really having a tough time and it took them a month to get in to see me. And today they got a 26. So, I like to be able to communicate directly with my primary care colleague and to tell my patient that too, to say, I'm just meeting you for the first time. You have known your primary care colleague for years and they were worried enough to ask me to see you. And I'm going to talk to him or her and, we're going to make sure that we're covering all the bases, both in terms of your existing medical conditions and your medications, and make sure we both agree that we don't need to go further with the workup because we think that we have an explanation for why that test score was particularly low on that day. So is that the kind of collaboration that you find that you do with your specialty colleagues when the opportunities arise?
Yeah, absolutely. So we let off with discussing team-based care with the patient in the center, but team-based care only works if you're all talking to one another. And so I think that I always like to say that I feel like if I see there's a clear opportunity here for initiating treatment, say with a cholinesterase inhibitor or memantine, but they're not seeing you for another 3 months, I see that we're progressing now to more moderate levels of dementia. So I'll go ahead and initiate the medication, but I'll make sure that you as a specialist know that. And the patient and, you know, their supporters understand that too, so we can all stay on the same page moving forward. So I always say that if it's clear what's, you know, that this is, there's something to be done proactively, constructively to help the patient. And this, it applies to dementia care, but certainly also with heart failure or COPD, any number of a million conditions. Go ahead and make that move. Just make sure you communicate that move. You know, I think that unfortunately, when you wait for the specialist or that you wait for that next appointment, that's only 3 weeks away, but say maybe, especially in cases of cognitive impairment, that patient misses the appointment, they couldn't get a ride, et cetera. There's a million things that can go with it. You know, they've just forgot. And then 6 months go by, boy, that's a lot of a lost opportunity. So you want to avoid clinical inertia. You know, everybody can have a voice in helping take care of the patient. So work to the level of your abilities. And again, just communicate it out. And I think you'll find that those are very good results.
I love that, Chuck. I think, you know, it's great when my colleague says, hey, I know you're seeing this patient next month, but I went ahead and added this medication. And maybe, you know, instead of me giving them a call, you can just check and see how it's going and give me feedback. And it really feels like the right way to do practice.
I think it's actually also more satisfactory. We see so much burnout. And I think that level of collegiality where you're able to, you know, get to know a little bit some of your colleagues who may be in separate offices across town or whatever, I think that's really helpful, actually.
I do, too. It definitely, you know, feels like the kind of collegiality that we all need more of. So in the last couple of minutes, I think there are a couple other topics that relate to this. And one of those is shared decision making. How do you think about the process of shared decision making when you're talking with people with a cognitive concern and you're trying to, you know, think forward about what's this workup, you know, going to lead to, and how do we think together about which things you want to prioritize?
Well, this is an interesting issue for my practice in particular, because I see 80% of my patients prefer speaking Spanish. We also have a very large South Asian population in Orange County, California. And in both cultures, you know, the older folks are generally venerated, and the family takes a great responsibility. And it's expected that as they get older and develop dementia, that their family will take care of them, and all the way through severe case of dementia. I've seen some incredibly heroic supporters of patients who really had, you know, severe agitation and really needed complete 24-hour care. And some folks have given up not years of their life to care for that older adult. But at the same time, I always address the patient. I always present, you know, the facts to the patient, even as they develop more severe symptoms of dementia. And it's clear that, you know, they're not really engaged with the decision-making process. I always try to maintain that relationship and have the focus on the patient. But then by that time, usually the supporters, as you said, are in the clinic with them and bring in their appointments. And so making sure that, again, we're a team now, and, you know, really the most valuable member of that team at that point is that supporter. And so we all want to be clear on that, but I still want to maintain patient autonomy and work directly with the patient.
Yeah, I completely agree. I had a patient yesterday who has progressive aphasia that probably is going to turn out to be due to Alzheimer's disease. And I was speaking with her about the results of her workup so far and the next steps. And she was looking directly at me, and we were, you know, having an appropriate conversation. She's still quite mildly impaired. And her husband was sitting next to her, and her daughter was sitting behind her, and they both were taking vigorous notes. And she said, "Doc, isn't it great that I brought my secretaries with me to the visit today?"
Yeah, those are the moments, right? That's what we love to see. And, you know, we want to preserve that wit and that joy for as long as possible. And I think that, yeah, especially now, I think we have more hope than we've had in a long time when it comes to treating Alzheimer's disease particularly.
Yeah, and I think we've woven this through the whole conversation, but it's really the patients are not just the individuals with these diagnoses, but also their care partners and ultimately caregivers. You know, they may be a partner at the beginning of the journey, but they certainly give care as the condition progresses, as you were just saying, Chuck. And so it's really important to, I think, be as inclusive as possible and recognize the challenges and the healthcare burdens and psychosocial burdens that many family members are very willing to engage in, but that we have to just be vigilant about when it comes to their own health. I'm sure you think a lot about that, especially for families that you're probably providing primary care for multiple members of the family.
I will say that it's very interesting, and I think of a couple of examples where I was thinking of these caregivers and just having to restart their lives again when eventually that parent did pass away. And it's just been really interesting to try to help them on that journey. But it is a huge reset, is all I can say. So it's been, and it takes, that's where we want our mental health folks and our social workers and case managers really engaged, because they can provide some vital resources at that stage.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have the great privilege of caring for people through the end of their life as well. And I think we always make sure that the family members get the kind of grief counseling and other support that they need after their loved one passes away. And because, as you say, they often don't know what to do with themselves after they've been spending full time taking care.
Yeah. And I mean, I think this is one of the great privileges of being in healthcare, is you really get to get in touch with the human condition in such a vital and close way. And I feel like that is one of the things I've really learned a lot from these families. Over time, it's just taught me a lot about what it means to be dedicated and kind and diligent. And so that stuff lasts a long time for me.
Me too. It's one of the real silver linings of medicine. So thank you so much for joining me today, Chuck. I appreciate you sharing your perspectives on the diagnosis and management of these conditions. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. We hope you will listen to another episode from this series. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group in support of improving patient care. Med Learning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with ACCME Essentials. And I'd like to give a special thank you to our supporter, Lily, who provided an unrestricted educational grant for this activity. Thank you and have a great day.